So we can get started here. So it's my pleasure to introduce Yuta Becerra. Yuta comes to us from the University of Arizona at Tucson, coming originally from Mexico City, and having done work, really like some of the greatest, neatest work on plant herbivore coevolution in the group of Bursera and the beetles that feed on them. So yeah, without much more introduction, let you get
Thank
on with
you.
The talk.
Thank you. Can we lower the lights a little bit, please? Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you. Thank you, Ian. The word coevolution was coined by Ehrlich and Radin about 3 decades ago, probably a little bit more now, to describe the evolutionary impacts that plants and the insects that feed on them have on each other. In biology, the word coevolution in general means that a trait of one species evolved in response to a trait of another species, which trait itself evolved in response to the trait in the first. So, in simpler words, coevolution means reciprocal adaptation. And the concept of coevolution has become increasingly important since it was first proposed, because in part it's supposed to explain the diversification of insects and plants on Earth, two of the most diverse groups of organisms in terrestrial ecosystems. So it has become really important because of that. But so it turns out that really coevolution is not very easy to identify in nature. We many times see matching traits in plants and insects that we think, oh, it's a product of coevolution, no? Like defenses in plants, physiological counter defenses in the insects, and we think, oh, this is the product of coevolution. But now we know that we really have to be more careful about the use of that word. Because we have examples in the literature in which we see that sometimes, like adaptations that we see in the plants, evolved millions of years before, no? Because those plants are very, very old, and the insects that now feed on them are very, very recent, are originated just very recently. So yeah, probably for the insects, they adapted to the plants, but the plants with all those defenses that they have, secondary compounds or other things, well, they probably did not evolve for those insects because those insects didn't exist at the time, no? They may have evolved for some reason that don't even have to do anything with herbivory. So now we know that we have to be more careful. So when we are thinking of coevolution now, we try to see, to have more idea of really what happened with those groups of organisms. And one thing we would like to see is whether those groups that are now interacting and have matching traits diversified on time, diversified more or less at the same time. And the other thing is whether those adaptations and counter adaptations that we see also evolve more or less at the same time, so that we can have at least another source of evidence that tells us that they evolve in response to each other. So I'm going to show you a system in which the interactions that we see, traits, the some of the traits that we see seem to be the products of coevolution. I have worked with this system for the last 20 years. Some of the pictures you are going to see are probably from the Pleistocene, because I started so many years ago. But this group is the genus of plants Bursera in the Burseraceae, and the insects that feed on them are the genus Blepharida. It's a great smelly genus. And the plants, the genus includes about 110 species. They are mostly from Mexico, because 85% of them are in Mexico. About 80% of them are endemic to Mexico. So it's a is mostly Mexican genus. And they're really gorgeous plants. It's not because those are the plants that I have studied for many years, but they are really pretty, pretty plants. Look at these trunks that are succulent. Just the shape of some of those plants are really neat. Mostly they are medium-sized trees and shrubs like this. And the bark in some of the species exfoliates in these papery sheets with different colors. So in Mexico, they call them a leprous tree, guajiote, that means a leprous tree. And they inhabit the tropical dry forest of Mexico. And you know why they are called the dry forest is because in the rainy season, they look very lush and pretty and green like this. And then in the dry season, they look completely different. All the plants lose the leaves, and there is not much happening in terms of herbivory either. Those plants, those forests, the tropical dry forests, are in all these areas. It's a pretty extensive kind of vegetation in Mexico, all these areas in here. But bursers are particularly abundant. I mean, they are abundant everywhere. But they are particularly abundant in this area, in the south of Mexico, what is called the depression of the Balsas River. Here, the genus really goes wild. It becomes the dominant woody taxon, surpassing legumes, cactus, many things. They are really, really diverse and abundant there. And they are not only endemic at the level of the country. Many of them are endemic really at the level of the species, highly endemic. Look at this. Many of them, for many of them, their geographic ranges don't pass from 50,000 square kilometers. So you really find them in very localized areas in Mexico. And it's really not frequent to find a species of ample distribution. Many of them are small endemics. In that way, it's very much like those, it's typically tropical genus. And these are the insects. They are also beautiful. As you can see, they belong in the group of the flea beetles. They are kind of difficult to catch. But once I see them, I have to have them. So anyway, the genus includes about 45 species in the New World. And it has a comparable number in the Old World. A comparable number of species. And they all feed on Bursera and nothing else. That's all. The genus Bursera is the main source of food and the only source of food. And they are very specialized not only at the level of genus, but also at the level of species. Many of them, the majority of them, feed on only one, maybe two different species of Bursera. There are a few. That I call them polyphagous, but this is really relatively polyphagous because they feed on a bunch of plants, but they are all Burseras. They are all different Bursera species. And because they are highly monophagous, the diversity and abundance of the insects really mirrors the diversity and abundance of the plants. So you find many, many of these insects in this area in particular. Now, let me tell you about the matching traits that we study. Like many other plants, Burseras produce secondary compounds, mostly terpenoids. Sesquiterpenes and monoterpenes are the compounds that are more diverse and abundant. But they also produce other things, like, of course, other kinds of terpenes as well, but also alkanes, aromatic compounds, coumarins, etc. And really, there is a lot of variation between different species of plants in terms of not only of the number of compounds that they produce, but also the different classes of compounds that they produce. And these compounds, of course, make resins, no? like in pines. And they are these resins are stored in canals inside the plants, in networks of canals that run throughout the cortex of the stems and in the leaves. And in some of these plants, something that is very interesting is that the not on all of the species of Borsa, but in some of them, these fresings in the canals are under pressure. So when the plants are damaged, there is this immediate release of abundant resin coming from the injured tissues. You see, all this is resin in here, and the pressure is strong enough that it makes a squirt. This is all resin. And this is different species do it, about like one third of the Burseras do it. This is Bursera brandowski. This is Bursera trimera. And look at what is going to happen here. Let me see. Did you see that? So this bird can travel up to 2 meters away. I'm gonna put it again because it took me a long time to take that. Well, I didn't do it, but it took us a long time to get that shot of that. There it goes. So anyway, this resin squirt can be a tremendous challenge for any insect that doesn't know how to deal with abundant resins that happen so suddenly. So depending on the size of the insect, they can be completely drenched in resins, they can drown in resins, or the biggest ones are lucky because they may get only their heads all covered with resins, and they look really sad when that happens. for many of them, that is that means death for sure. So this is another one, another squirting Borsera's Lake Tendali. And of course, there are some of these beetles that can feed on these plants, and they are specialized, and they can feed on them because they can deactivate those canals. This is Blepharida slectendali biting on the midrib of the leaf of one of its castle in one host. And it bites here very, very slowly because it has to diffuse that that resin very slowly so that it doesn't come out, and it has to come out slowly. It may take them hours to do that. But then, after that, very happily, they go and feed on the leaves. And this is another species of Blepharida. Different species do it in different ways because the plants are tricky. They have the arrangement of the canals in different ways. So, It's fun to change, to transplant species of Blepharida from one species to another and see whether they can deactivate canals, and often they cannot. And it's like they try, and they go and bite on the leaf, and no, it's still coming, and try. So it's nice because it gives us an idea of how the canals are and which ones are similar or different. And so about one third of the Borseras do that. Okay, they squirt, they produce abundant resins. Then about a third of them produce just tiny amounts, not so many. And then there are some Borseras that do not squirt anything at all. You break the leaves and everything, no liquids come out. Of course, we know that there are chemicals in there, but it's just not the kind that makes these squirts. And of course, the insects that feed on them, the species, they're specialized insects, do not cut veins in here. They just go feeding on the leaves like nothing, like if it was just another plant. So we have these squirting and non-squirting Borseras, and I would like you to see the difference in chemistry that these plants have. I'm going to contrast one squirting Borsera with one that doesn't have a squirt. This is the relative abundance, and this is the retention time in the column. Just telling you that very the smaller retention times means that the molecules are smaller and they are more volatile. Those compounds are more volatile. And higher retention times means bigger molecules, not as volatile. So Borsera lancifolia here produces monoterpenes, no smaller molecules. As a matter of fact, produces mostly one, limonene. And then this one produces a bunch of compounds. These are the main ones, but it produces many more that in on a more even relative abundance. So these ones here tend to be more complicated in chemistry. This one is very simple, one compound, and these ones produce many more compounds. So we have different matching traits. We have here squirting plants, we have the matching insects that deactivate these canals, and then we have this very complex or relatively more complex procerus, and then the beetles that have the physiology to feed on this, to detoxify or to use somehow to feed on this plant. So we want to see whether these traits are because of coevolution. See when this group that you could tell if those adaptations and counter adaptations were concurrent, happened more or less at the same time. So for that we had to reconstruct a phylogeny for the plants. Here it is. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing about phylogeny because everything is published. So here are all these species. You don't really have to see them. It's just the different names. And we also wanted to know when these adaptations originated, right? So we had to have timings of divergence of all these species. So fortunately, we could calibrate the phylogeny because there are fossils of Bursera. This is in particular, there are several fossils, but in particular, this is very nice because it's very precise in its morphology, looking very much like this extant species here, Bursera tecomata. So we set the, we marked this node in the phylogeny to be the minimum age for the diversification of this group of Burseras, because Bursera tecomata came here. Just to show you, you use different Burseraceae genera. We actually recently redid the Burseraceae, the timing of the Burseraceae, and give us very similar results. But the sister group of Bursera is Commiphora. And here is now the phylogeny. We did the same with the insects. This is, it came very nicely with the new word Blepharida on one clade, and then the sister clade being the African Blepharida, no, the old word Blepharida. And this is very interesting. This old word Blepharida feed on Commiphora, which is the sister genus to Bursera. So, in Africa, they are feeding on the Burseras of Africa. So we didn't have any fossils to time calibrate our phylogeny here, but we could use biogeographic data because we could use the time of separation of Africa and the sub-mega continent to mark the separation of our two clades, the African and the American clades of Blepharida. So that's what we did. And now we have here the two phylogenies, one against the other one. And here is the time axis. This is the Blepharida phylogeny. This is present and this is past. This is present, this is past, but these are the plants. The first thing that we wanted to see is when the diversification of these two groups happened. Well, it turned out that the diversification of the American Blepharida happened sometime around 78 million years. Okay, that's when they started diversifying, and Bursera, the plants, started diversification about 76 million years. So yeah, these insects and these plants have been battling each other for a long time. So their diversifications really coincide. Of course, I am not showing here the confidence limits. They are actually pretty large. But I mean, that's the way it goes with calibrating phylogenies. Now let me show you the matching traits. In colors in here, in these ones, forget about the green, okay? In all these colors are the versus that have the squirting response. And they're connected to line to the blepharidas that can feed on them, here and here and here. So let me just put it closer up, most of them. And as you can see, the ability to squirt evolved, originated a long time ago. The oldest Bursera that can squirt, and squirts really well, is Bursera brandowski, that apparently diverged about 26 million years ago. The oldest Lephida that can feed on those plants separated about 29 million years. So in general, the squirting Borseras go from 26 million years to about 8 million years of in timing when they diverge. And it's pretty concurrent really when those insects that can feed on them also separated. Forget these green ones. So these ones are the ones that can do it. And as I say, the confidence limits are very, in general, tend to be very wide. Calibrating phylogenies is not an exact science. It's really, there is really a lot of imprecision built in there. And really what we wanted to see was to have an idea on whether they were kind of more or less at the same time, as opposed to having plants or insects completely at different times, right? Because that's very much what you can do right now with phylogenies. But I mean, this shows that, yeah, there is some concordance in those findings. Now let's go see the plants that have that very, the chemistry is very is more complex. Here they are in green. Those ones are more recent addition to the Borseras, and they are a bit of an really like 5 million years ago, which is roughly concordant with the time that these insects that feed on them have on. The time when they separate. All these ones are about the same time. This one has the same name because the taxonomist who is the expert on the group thinks it's only one species. All those that we send him, he says, well, they all look the same. But, I mean, there is enough variation in the molecular data that we think there is something going on with there, probably different cryptic species or something. And species or whatever they are, they seem to have more or less the same timing of divergence than the plants that produce those more complex mixtures of chemistry, of chemicals. So yeah, it seems to be, I mean, we see these matching traits, and the information that we get with the phylogenies that they are probably products of coevolution. So we have the plants here, very old, when they're getting this defense, this square defense, the insects catching up, the plants getting another kind of defense, and then again, insect catching up. So this is what we envision as a coevolutionary scenario. Okay, now I'm going to go into something else, now that I show you that there may be coevolution in that system. I have, when the hypothesis of Ehrlich and Rebbe came out, it came with a series of predictions, fundamental for the knowledge, for the understanding of relationships between insects and plants. And they proposed that the secondary, the diversity of secondary compounds in plants was the result of selection from specialized herbivores. The reasoning was that related insects tend to feed on plants with similar chemistry. So By related insects, he means that, so when they go evolving, that's why they are related. As insects go evolving, they tend to attack plants with similar chemistry, which is also something easy to understand. If an insect is going to colonize a new host, it's probably easier to colonize one that has the same chemistry, the same defensive chemistry of that of the old host, that if the chemistry was completely different. So they say because of that, they impose pressures on plants to become chemically different. And that's where all those compounds come, are the result of, because of herbivores going on attacking plants with similar chemistry. They went on to say that progressive steps in attacks and defense, what is coevolution, is what is responsible for the incremental diversity of secondary compounds in plants. So throughout time, we should be able to see that there is an increment in diversity of secondary compounds in plants in general, because coevolution is taking place over time, so more compounds should be appearing as time passes. And then this is the part where why they became really famous. They proposed that innovations in attack and defense have allowed insects and plants to colonize new adaptive zones where further evolution and divergence and speciation can occur. That's why they predict that coevolution explains how insects and plants radiated on Earth. So I have gone through the last many years trying to test many of the proposals of this coevolutionary theory. But let me tell you something first. It's still one of the major paradigms of herbivore-plant interactions, but remains mostly untested. I mean, many things have been really, especially some parts on whether secondary compounds really are to deter herbivores or not. But besides that, it remains untested in many, many aspects. And the reason was that this is mostly an evolutionary hypothesis, a macroevolutionary hypothesis. So we had to wait until phylogenies, all the theory about phylogenies got developed and anything, so we could start testing this theory. And now, they have been very largely criticized, very criticized because ecology is not very much taken into account in that for that theory. And they are right. Ecology doesn't figure very much in the part of this theory. So, as I say, well, I decided that I was going to start testing these things with my plants and my insects. So I started trying to see if really, as insects go on to time evolving, they tend to feel plants with similar chemistry. So this is something I did many, many years ago. It's one of the first things I did with this group. You see here about 38 species of Burseria, and those were the ones that we have been studying at this time only. And this is not a phylogeny. This is a dendrogram of Burseria species based on their chemical similarity. So we analyzed the chemistry of all these plants, and we did this dendrogram. And so just to see which species were more similar to each other and to others. So that's what this dendrogram means. Now here, we do have a phylogeny. This is a phylogeny of the insects, of the Blepharida insects that feed on these plants. And as you can see, it looks a little bit different. It's just shorter. What happens is we didn't have as many species of insects at the time. And also many of the names say undescribed, not known, or something like that. Because when I started working with Blepharida, the taxonomy we saw that there were about 10 species. It turned out to be 40. So he had a lot of work after we came back every time from those field trips in Mexico, because he had to describe all those species that we brought. So anyway, in this phylogeny of the Blepharida, we mapped the Burseria species they were feeding on, okay? So this one, for example, these are these species. So you can see that this lineage, now as they evolve, when attacking plants in here. Then these ones, they went on attacking plants in here, another group, chemically related species. And this one went attacking mostly plants in this chemically related group. So yes, it seems that related insects tend to feed on plants with similar chemistry. Okay, they got it right in there. These are the polyphagous species that feed on many different kinds of plants. They don't follow the same pattern as the monophagous species. So, okay, if they are feeding on plants with similar chemistry, do they impose pressures on plants to become chemically different? Now, this is not very easy to test. What I decided there is that it was time for ecology to start appearing in the panorama. So I decided that interactions between insects and plants, they take place in communities, in ecological communities. That's where evolution is taking place. No, it's not in the vacuum of evolution. So if that is what is happening, then we should see the results of coevolution also at the level of ecological communities. If herbivores tend to feed on plants that are chemically similar, they should limit the coexistence of potential host species that are chemically similar, right? So what we are thinking is that the chemical characteristics of plants in a community is not random, okay? They are dissimilar, because they are trying to avoid being eaten by those herbivores. So communities, the arrangement of communities should not be random in terms of chemistry. If this is really happening, if Eric and Raven are right, then communities should be chemically overdispersed. And that's what we went to test. Now, Ehrlich and Revit have said that it was specialized herbivores, the ones that were causing all these pressures on plants. And the reason for that is that highly specialized insects tend to develop specific adaptations for their hosts. They usually exploit their hosts better and they cause more damage. So if there is more damage, then the higher the pressure, the higher the selection that should be for chemical divergence. I suppose, for example, if we have more generalized insects, because really those insects develop more generalized traits, they are having to deal with different hosts. And they tend to, because of that, they are not as good as these ones are exploiting their hosts. So lower pressures, lower selection for chemical divergence. So we took that into account, and we went all over Mexico and collected samples of Broseras from everywhere that we could find. We collected 65 species, collected also populations, different populations for the ones that had a more ample distribution. And then we analyzed their chemistry again, and we identified the compounds, and we also see the relative abundance of those compounds. And then with that data, we really could tell how dissimilar they were, one species of Ursa with respect to another. No? We did correlation analysis based on that chemical data, and we really could tell how chemically distant was one species with respect to another species. And we had that for all the 65 species we collected. So we selected seven areas in Mexico to test for chemical overdispersion. Areas here, 1 to 5, in red, all of these ones have lots of Broseras and amplified species. But 1 to 5, we knew that there were going to be more monophagous species, more specialized species. 6 and 7, in area 6 and 7, the polyphagous species tend to occur. For some reason, they like this coastal area in here. And they go after all Broseras in these areas. So in these ones, there was relatively less specialization in these areas than in these ones. So you can see all of these ones are 1 degree latitude and longitude. And then before I tell you how we did it, I want you to think of the topography of the south of Mexico. Who has been in the south of Mexico in here? Yeah, how is the topography there? Lots of mountains, right? Lots of mountains, yes, exactly. Lots of sierras, mountains. It's really accidented. Well, the tropical dry forests tend to be at the bottom of the canyons where those mountains are, because it's really nice and warm, hot and warm, hot, dry and warm over there. And so at the end in those mountains you have oaks, pines, etc. But at the bottom you have the dry forests. And the vertebrates tend to stratify themselves along these canyons. Some of them are only at the base of the canyons, really, really at the bottom. And others tend to occupy more higher altitudes and they really don't mix with the ones in here. And then some others do the same thing. They are really closer to the oaks than to these guys over here, and they don't mix very much with these ones. So we say, okay, where should we be measuring this over dispersion? So when in ecology, many times you don't know, because depending on the scale where you measure things, the results are going to be different. So we say, okay, we are going to measure it at different scales and see what happens. So we have some the smallest scales here, then a scale that was bigger than that, larger than that, going in altitude, and then an even bigger scale, and then also increasing the size of the instead of being one degree latitude and longitude, we did 3 and 3. So these were the 4 scales we used. And then we did randomization tests to really see if those communities were randomly or not arranged in terms of their chemistry. So we calculated the observed value of the average of chemical distance in our species in a focal community. And we knew very well how to do that, because we had this matrix that told us exactly how they were, how the distance between those species was. And then we compared that value to averages obtained from 10,000 random communities of equal size. So if our focal community had 10 species, well, we had a program that got 10 species randomly from our, and then calculated the distance between those species. So, okay, with that, we constructed a null distribution of average distance, and we saw where our observed value fell. So, if communities were really, the average distance was really high, it would go over here, right? So we use the p-values as an index of which communities deviated more from random. And here are the results. This is for area one. And as you can see, we measured the percentage of bursa species attacked by Monophagus blepharida. Been very high, as we expected, especially at some scales. These are the scales, 1, 2, 3, 4. One is the smallest scale. And yes, we see these high levels of specialization in here. We see that the distance, the chemical distance between the species is higher than we would expect from random. Would you imagine that? Really? You go in the field, and this is another thing that is making the community get structured in a different way, but it's a chemical way. So the plants in there are paying attention to the chemistry of the others. I thought that was really exciting. So this is another result of AS2 and 3. Same thing happened. The higher the specialization, the level of specialization in those areas, in those communities, the higher the distance in those, the chemical distance in those communities. And we are finding it in every place. That's why I'm not showing you results of 4 and 5, because it was exactly the same. that, hey, look now what happens in AS6 and 7, which where there is not much specialization because our polyphago species is there. There is no chemical distance. It's more like a random arrangement of chemistry in the species in there. So this is a summary of what happens at the lowest scales. This is areas 1 through 5, high monophagy, high specialization, 6 and 7, not as much specialization. These are the values of chemical distance for our, for random, and the other ones coming out higher than that. Now let's put all of the communities that we measured together. And for that, of course, we had to build a statistical model that took into account that some of the communities were being counted more than once. This is the C value for chemical distance, which is just how far the mean is from the P value, from the observed value. The higher the C value, the higher the chemical dissimilarity in that community. Yes. And it's a very strong pattern. You increase specialization, you increase the chemical distance among the species in that community. Very, very strong pressure. So yes, that chemistry diverges. I mean, it was really exciting to me that they were doing it. But not only that, it was actually depending on how specialized those insects were. Okay, Ehrlich and Rabin got it right again in there. So what happens if we this part about secondary compounds being more diverse as time passes? Well, we could do that. We had pretty much all of the information because we had time-calibrated phylogeny and we had the chemistry for all of the species. So we had times of divergence for all these species, and we knew their chemistry. So I say, okay, is chemically diversity higher in more recently derived species? This is axis, this is present, and this is past. Yes, tends to be, even if you exclude these species here. This is a nice relationship in which species are producing more and more compounds in the plants. Here is one, Bursera arida, the one that has most compounds, very difficult. It was one of the most difficult because it has tons of things. And we have never seen a Blepharida species in this plant. So anyway, yes, this happens, but then look at these stars in here. These are the sporting Burseras that want to trash the relationship completely, right? Why? They don't care. They don't care. They have, in my interpretation, they have this very potent defense. Why do they care about putting more or making more compounds if they have this tremendous defense that can stop many, many things? So at least that is my interpretation. But now, one thing is producing many different compounds, and another thing is making different kinds, different classes of compounds, right? Once you have a chemical pathway, you vary it a little and produces another compound, closely related compound. But, it shouldn't be that difficult. The probability that happens is higher than, for example, if you have to have another pathway, another chemical pathway. And this makes things more, plants probably would like that because that makes usually more difficult for insects to detoxify because they have to have another pathway for detoxification, no? Depending on what they are. But so this makes it more difficult. So we analyze not only just how many compounds they have, but whether they belong to these different kinds of compounds. So to have an index of chemical complexity. And yes, it happens again. And again, our species, the squirting Burseras, trashing the whole relationship. If you take them out, this has very, very nice, more stronger correlation. the correlation gets stronger. So yes, it seems that the species, as they evolved in time, they started producing not only more compounds, but also compounds that belong to different different chemical pathways, right? That make it, in a way, increasingly more difficult for the insects to deal with. Now, we only wanted to see if, in general, there has been an increase in overall number of compounds, or if different species are making, yes, different compounds, but they are very similar to the other plants. It's just taking, has it really increased at the level of genus? Well, there it is not, it wasn't that easy to do, because it involved doing a phylogenetic reconstruction of each chemical compound to see when they first appear with these species. Because we have a calibrated phylogeny, we could tell at what time a given compound started for the first time. But you know, the problem is that if you have only extant species, you don't really know what was happening here. Meaning there was lots of extinction here, and we don't have that data. So you don't really know if how this happened. So we went and studied speciation and extinction in Borsa. And we just wanted to have an idea of how important extinction has been in the group. Here we have an accumulation of species through time. It's just the lineages. When you count this, every time when there's a new lineage appears. But we knew that this was the result of both extinction and speciation. So we have to go do different things. There are people who dedicate the research to looking at the mark that has left extinction in phylogenies. Because apparently extinction, depending on how it goes, if it is large or small or constant or not constant, I cannot go into detail, but then the phylogenies look different. So there are people who do all these things all the time, and it's great to have them, because then you can use their models to see, it, just to have an idea how was extinction. And for our, data, the likelihood model that fit the data better was one that had no extinction. Of course, there was extinction but it was just not it wasn't rampant. It wasn't important enough that the model can pick it up. So that tells, okay, there was some extinction, but not large, so that we can continue doing our analysis. So we went on and, stop. Doesn't want to go. What should I do? Okay, it's doing it now. So we know now that accumulation of lineages is more or less the result of speciation. So we could go and reconstruct each one of the chemical compounds that we found in the plants and see when it evolved first. Here's one, here's another one. Linalyl acetate is a recent addition to the arsenal of Bursera. Now this Bursera is used a lot to obtain linalyl acetate. This is a plant that smells really wonderful. So now we have not only the accumulation of species, but we also have the accumulation of compounds. How is it going in here? And as you can see, there you go, the species, and at the beginning, the speciation is going slowly. So the production of new chemical compounds keeps up with the number of species. But then the plants go really into fast speciation, and then the the production of new compounds that have not appeared in the genus before starts going more slowly. It cannot keep up. And you can see it more easily, again, with the slopes in here, this going more slowly than this one in here. And my interpretation is that really it's not easy to be generating compounds all the time, especially when species are many species are being produced. It's just that not giving enough time for mutation and recombination to take place. So it's just not happening. But it's also telling us that the plants are doing something very interesting, very smart. I mean, there are different ways in which you can be different as a plant, if that is what is required. You can just increase your concentration of one compound and become really different, even when many others have it. Or you can play with the different compounds once they are in the pool of species. Maybe it is easier to get different compounds. I mean, that they are present already, but just the combinations are different. Also, taking advantage of their endemism, this is something that birds do a lot. One species here can be very different to the other species in here just by having one compound, because the other species that has it is in another area completely different. So they are different in their own geographic area. So yes, it seems that there has been an increase in the secondary compounds produced in the genus as well, not keeping pace with the species, but it's still increasing. So I just want, this is my last slide, I just want to summarize. This group of insects and plants have interacted at Webull for millions of years. Blephy that has evolved attacking Perseras of the same chemistry. And very specialized Blephyida seem to have selected for chemical dissimilarity within Persera communities. And it is likely that the selected pressures of Blephyida have caused an increase in the chemical diversity and complexity of Persera. And if this is representative of other plant groups, then it could explain the high diversity that exists in plant secondary compounds in plants in general. Many different groups of plants. And I don't know if there takes time for questions. I would be happy to answer if you have any.
I think we have time for a couple of questions.
Yes.
So I really like this community approach to the co-evolutionary look, and it raises this interesting question about the rest of the community. So you do have this Bursera community and you have a beetle community, but it's really only one group of beetles. And so I wondered whether colleagues of yours, I mean, I know you work as intensely on this group, is there any sense of how the chemistry, you know, making this nice argument about diversification at the local community, how does this fit into maybe a slightly larger community context? Do you think that plays a role at all?
Well, what happens? I think for the case of Blepharida, it may not have, it may not play a role. The rest of the community, they don't even know that those other plants exist. They cannot even recognize them. I mean, for them, they are things in there. They don't feed on them. I mean, they are there. They go around flying and everything, but they cannot attack them for some reason, right? They are not even closely related things.
So Bursera is really only attacked by this beetle, but not other.
No. I'm talking just about Blepharida. For Blepharida, those plants are what exists in the community. Now, for Bursera, that's a different thing because other things are also attacking them. But these other things are more unpredictable. Some years they appear, some days are not. Blepharida is the one that year after year after year appears and causes damage. So those are the ones that are probably causing the putting the pressure on the plants. The other ones are like a more random thing. The plant, yes, well, okay, today I want to defend myself, but next year, where is that herbivore? So I imagine that they have to be responding to more predictable herbivory that is also extensive. These beetles can defoliate plants completely, trees that you are